Monday, November 25th. This is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier. I am here with Hayes Davenport.
Hi, Scott.
And an empty Melissa Walker shaped spot on vacation. Just the two of us today. We will have a guest joining us at the end of this episode, Jessica Meany of local transit advocacy group Investing in Place, here to talk about their current ongoing platform to get us bus lanes. And that will be very exciting for all of us to talk about, especially myself, as I am frequently very mad about bus lanes online.
It's been a while since we used to talk about protected bus lanes in every episode dedicated bus lanes, but it's been like a couple months, so it'll be fun to have a guest come
return to form
to talk about just that. I'm sorry, my voice is a little shot. I went to the Clippers Rockets game last night, and it was a lot of screaming. That is such a, it was an awesome game. They won, and they debuted the City Edition jerseys, which are very like LA'd out. So the new Clippers rebrand is like very LA intensive. There's a lot of maps. The court has like maps of different parts of LA on it. And a lot of their branding does as well.
Like Inglewood, for example, is that?
Yeah, it's blueprints.
Just an arrow to the new stadium.
Yeah, and a bunch of raised apartment buildings. But the jerseys are based on, like the font of the City jerseys are based on the work of Mr. Cartoon, who is a Mexican tattoo artist based in L.A. It's what people, like a lot of people said it looks like the GTA San Andreas font kind of, but that's all based on Mr. Cartoon. It is probably a very, like a savvy ploy to work their way into the hearts of Angelenos as they build this enormous and potentially disruptive new stadium. But how do you?
I mean, well, as like
further disrupt Inglewood at this point.
I mean, as far as the franchise is concerned, as far as the team is concerned, like it makes a lot of sense when you have when was it? Like it was like during a Rams game, I think, that they like brought out or they just like showed Kawhi Leonard on like the big screen and people were just booing, even though it was like not even a Lakers event. It was like a
really before he showed up, like after he came to the Clippers, they did that. Oh, that's crazy.
It was like in August or something. So yeah, it makes sense to try and like, you know, to put yourself forward as an LA entity
and not just an LA entity. They're trying to set themselves apart from the Lakers as like the working class LA basketball team. Like that's what the branding is kind of about. Like LA is like the Hollywood team. They are participating in class warfare with their new branding. So I guess that's my LA story. Did you have any stories from this week?
You know, my LA story, I guess, this from this past week is that one of my dogs, Alondra, had a serious like surgery.
Oh my God.
A week and a half ago. She had a couple of tumors removed. Oh. I got really good news this week, which was that it turned out that the one large growth was benign and the other one was, although it was cancerous, it was a very recoverable, very like low grade cancerous growth. So that was good news.
Oh, poor sweetie.
I know. It's my actual LA story is how pitiful she's been. Like as I've been walking her around, she has her cone.
Okay.
But more debilitating than that is that my vet tech told me that she couldn't go upstairs for like the first week, right? So I was like, I live on a second floor walk up. So, and the vet was like, well, you know, could you carry her? I was like, oh, she's 60 pounds. So yeah, I can, but not easily. So I'm like lifting her up with her cone. She's like walking around trying to like sniff things and just like sort of bouncing off of every hard surface. And it was sad, but it was also kind of, I mean, I was getting a lot of neighborly sympathy, which was nice. Like people coming over, being very sweet to her and kind of being like, why is her cone all caked in mud? I mean, I can't help that.
But just scoops it up as she goes.
She kind of is a shovel at this point, but
Fourplex living. They don't tell you about it in the brochure. No. You're going to have to carry your dog up the stairs.
It's like that Morgan Freeman movie, Five Flights Up, from a couple years ago.
I've never heard of this movie. A couple years ago.
Yes. Anyway, so she's doing better now. That was my
week. That's good. Thinking about Alondra. We want to talk about a couple of big stories related to housing and homelessness over the last week that I think are useful to talk about at once because I think they are both related to messaging and how housing and especially homelessness in LA right now is on such a like razor's edge in terms of like public opinion. And public opinion has a huge amount of influence over how we treat this problem. It's almost like exclusively a problem of political will. And there were two big pieces over the last week. One was a research paper and one was a series of columns that could have done a lot to influence public opinion and potentially in a harmful way, depending how you look at it.
Right.
Let's talk about these Steve Lopez columns. Steve Lopez is a guy who has, over a long storied career, written a lot about homelessness for the LA Times as a columnist. Most famously, some of his work was adapted into the movie The Soloist,
yep,
where he was played by Robert Downey Jr. Yeah. As a reporter who had developed a connection with a person who's homeless, suffering from mental illness, but it turned out to be a very talented violinist played by Jamie Foxx.
Cellist?
Was it a cellist?
I've never thought.
This week, he wrote a series of three columns.
Yeah.
Scott, what was some of the content of these columns?
So these columns came out. They were, I think, in a lot of homelessness and housing Twitter just kind of extremely looked on with disfavor because of the fact that the framing that Steve Lopez put forward, although, as you said, he has throughout his career kind of tried to forge personal relationships with individual homeless people. He's looking now at the state of homelessness in Los Angeles County and perpetuating a lot of the myths, the most particularly harmful myths that we hear frequently and we talk about frequently on the show about homeless individuals, namely that the problem is not, as you said, one of political will, but of there being too many homeless people and of the city and other political bodies being helpless to actually do what they need to do to decrease the level of homelessness here. So Steve Lopez's column really focused on where are these homeless people coming from? How many homeless people can we and should we be expected to support here locally? And then what are the behaviors of homeless people? Are they choosing to be homeless? Could they, through their own volition, find housing? And are they choosing not to do it? And then, therefore, are we being stuck with a dead social weight? Is kind of the only way that I was able to read these articles, is that it's implicating that homelessness is a burden thrust upon Los Angeles from without, and that kind of giving a respectable voice to the sentiment that we should not have to care for the homeless people who live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, there were three columns that all came out at once online. One was about the situation that homeowners were put in and quote Hollywood residents,
yeah,
when a homeless camp rose outside of their window.
Yep.
These were all kind of centered around Hollywood and I think really like a couple of specific encampments. Some people objected to the framing of residents versus people who are homeless, implying,
right,
that those people are not residents of the city as well.
Yep.
But the headline was, when an LA homeless camp rises outside your window, colon, you have no idea the hell I was living. That was the first one. The second one, the headline was, young people come from around U.S. to live on Hollywood streets. How much more can we take?
Yeah.
And that one I thought was really interesting. So it focuses on these groups of young people who do come from around the country to Los Angeles and don't have a living situation when they show up here. Though that kind of migration is centered around two parts of LA, Hollywood and Venice.
Yeah.
This article does focus on Hollywood. It does not mention the fact that the vast majority of people who are homeless in Los Angeles are first from Los Angeles, second from LA County, slightly larger group than that are from California. The percent that come from all over the U.S. is like 13%.
Right.
And no mention of that in this article, that this is a pretty subset.
Yeah, it's a very strange, it's a strange way to anchor people's thinking about this issue, right? Because it is not something where we always talk about, there is no evidence that backs up people are coming to Los Angeles to be homeless, which is something that is always put forward by people who are saying Los Angeles does not need to do more, other places need to do more, and we need to be able to basically offload our home, our surplus homeless population back to where they came from.
In fact, they say we need to do less in order to discourage people from coming.
Right.
That we're providing too many services and they're coming here because it's such a great life being homeless in Los Angeles.
Yes, people with InfoWars bumper stickers will be very eager to tell you that we are the best place in the world to be homeless.
That article, that column begins, "One day on Carlos Avenue in Hollywood last month, just south of the 101, I met a woman who goes by the name Raven. She said she was 29, had been homeless since she was 17, and headed west in June from her home in Ohio. Why LA? Why not?" That kind of, why LA, why not, elides a kind of important thing about this conversation, which is the reasons for young people coming to LA are very specific. Many of them are queer in some way and see LA as a place that is more accepting than the place that they came from.
Yep.
Which is how we like to think of ourselves and advertise ourselves as a city. Something like a place that will welcome kids that don't feel comfortable in their own homes or like places in the Midwest that aren't as accepting of them.
Absolutely. What is your read on like when you have that back and forth interchange? Why LA? Why not? Like, what function is that serving in Lopez's article? Like that, why not LA?
It's as if, I mean, yeah, it's like it's implying that they would just show up in a place like this randomly,
right?
Instead of because of the beacon that we have been sending out. I mean, it's one of the only things that we're really doing right as a city. Is promoting ourselves as a place where literally everyone is welcome. This is LA's tourism campaign.
Right.
And then people show up and we get the headline, "How much more can we take?"
Yeah.
What is functionally the difference between this and our immigration debate, where we have people from Central America who are unsafe in the place where they live, and they come to America seeking a better life, better conditions? Would Steve Lopez write a column about them with the headline, "How much more can we take?" I don't think so.
Yeah, I
think that would be considered rightly like an incredibly callous,
objectionable,
hard right position to take. Why is it okay to write about people from America who come to LA seeking acceptance and better opportunities?
And people who are suffering through poverty and some of the worst conditions anywhere in the country, right here in Los Angeles. And that the response is that we actually have done too, it's unimaginable to me that you would actually look at Los Angeles and think that we have too much of a safety net for people who have fallen into homelessness. I don't really care what other part of the country or the world you're comparing us to. It doesn't, to me, makes sense to say that we have done enough, or let alone that we should do less to discourage people from coming here. But like the argument that there is some kind of benefit to people who are suffering through social discrimination or inescapable poverty, that they should go back where they came from and just sort of deal with it because of the consternation that it might cause local homeowners who have done, frankly, everything in their power and sometimes more, extra legal vigilanteism to make life hell for the homeless here is despicable.
Who fantasize about pouring bleach on encampments, not just fantasize, sometimes do it.
Right.
But like on Facebook groups and next door, like different ways that they could like burn these encampments down. And in many cases do actually firebomb them. And the idea that, so Steve Lopez talks a lot in recent columns about this new program that I'm sure we'll get into in more detail that's modeled on what they've done in Trieste in Italy. There's a woman named Carrie Morrison who's pioneering this program that is designed to provide assistance to the people who need it most on the streets. People who have severe mental illness, severe substance use issues, like the people who are the lowest functioning, so to speak. Steve Lopez is in favor of this kind of approach, and he sees this issue as one of scarce resources where we're spending too much of our capital on the people who don't necessarily need the most help. Young people that just like showed up from other places and can kind of fend for themselves, people that can get themselves like up on their feet and like back into a job. I think the reality is those people are potentially the easiest to get into housing the most quickly, the ones that he's talking about. But those are also the people who, the longer they stay homeless, then they become
Chronically, yeah.
Chronically homeless, and they become the people that will then be eligible for the Trieste program.
Yeah, this is something that you have talked about, I think, at length in particular, like these pathways into chronic homelessness and the failure of the city to make sure that those pathways are being monitored in such a way that we can see people who are at risk of joining the ranks of people who have been homeless for more than a year and who start losing the sorts of connections that make it easier for them to get housing.
Yeah.
We have to address this at every step of the way, but it also doesn't make sense to say until you're chronically homeless, you're on your own.
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me either. I think We are really seeing a local culture war, right, in Los Angeles about what the city's response to this should look like. I think that we've seen a lot of movement politically in the course of the past year or so with a rising tide of local activist groups for providing adequate support and care to homeless individuals. We've also seen a lot of politicians, most notably, we talked about this a bit on Twitter. I brought up a city attorney, Mike Feuer, who has gone the other way, seemingly in real time. We've been able to watch him become more of a hardliner on basically taking away civil rights for the homeless in order to force them off the streets. Mark Ridley Thomas is supervisor of the second district, is also on the new task force that the governor created and is publicly supporting, again, the move to commit people, basically to put them under involuntary holds and citing that as a way out of this homelessness crisis that we have, as opposed to increasing the services that we provide, increasing the ability for people to get housing. And you have spoken about someone in particular that was like trying to get housing, but was, I mean, multiple people, but who have been trying actively and how difficult it is to get housed at all.
Yeah, I have some follow-ups on that story. I've been working with this couple. The woman is pregnant. I talked a little bit about the process of trying to go through the county and like calling 211 to get help with services, and that all they were really able to do is call PATH, a service provider who didn't pick up the phone and leave two messages, which if the job is not getting your calls answered by PATH, that I definitely know how to do. I also called the St. Joseph Center in Venice, left multiple messages. They never picked up the phone. Finally, contacted a LASA caseworker that I know. And so this is like, in the meantime, me and some other people from CELA are putting this couple up in a hotel, which is, I forget, did I talk about this hotel on the show?
I don't believe so.
It's basically an SRO.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's on the cheaper side. It's like bathrooms on the hallway, that kind of thing. But it's great. They're so happy there. Mm-hmm. I saw them the other night. They look amazing.
Yeah.
They're great. Like, they have a dog. The dog looks so, like, happy and healthy. But, you know, she's pregnant. We're trying to get her into, like, a more stable situation for going forward. Talked to this LASA caseworker who's great. He connected me to another LASA caseworker who is trying to help find a place for this couple to go. And the options that I got yesterday were she can get into a maternity shelter, but they would have to split up. He cannot go into the shelter, and the dog probably cannot either. Keep in mind, right now they are in basically a fine situation. If we could sustain this hotel, which costs $315 a week, it's not like way cheaper than whatever LASA would be spending in resources to put her into this maternity shelter. Like, that would be ideal. But they offer that. That's downtown.
Yeah.
And her clinic is in Hollywood. So it is kind of a schlep for a pregnant woman to be doing this, but it's not, you know, it's possible. But I mentioned the idea of a motel voucher, which in New York is the most standard practice possible. They are like throwing these things at people because by law they have to be provided shelter. And I was told that the motels that LASA traditionally works with, none of them are really in the Hollywood area. The ones that he offered up as possibilities were in Commerce and El Monte.
Oh, yeah. That's not easy to get
to. If you don't have a car.
No.
Even if you do have a car. At certain times of day, it will take hours to get out there.
If you don't have a car, you have either like Metrolink plus a probably unacceptable walking distance with like no pedestrian friendly environment
as a pregnant woman. And you're increasingly pregnant.
Right.
So it's so, I mean, I was like really depressed and angry about this for like a whole day about how these, they're set up. They need a little help covering an incredibly cheap cost,
yeah,
just to stay in this comfortable housing situation for the time being. And instead, Lhasa, all they have to offer is something worse.
Yeah.
Something worse and more expensive.
Yeah. And I like what's interesting to me is like if you think about like back in the Lopez articles, right? Like the centering of these homeowners who are saying the worst thing in the world that could happen is a homeless encampment going up outside of right. your home. And it's worse for me than it is for them, whatever that's basically implied, is that if you went to those same people and you were to like poll them and ask them if they supported legalizing SROs of the type that you're talking about, like right. the construction of new SRO units,
which are like single room occupancy,
old a bed
and a sink, yeah, board homes where you share bathrooms and other facilities, no kitchen or anything.
These were incredibly popular in like the 40s, yeah. right? I mean, well, so like in the Depression era, of course, but then again in the 40s in the post-war era after World War II ended and there was an mm-hmm. enormous unmet demand for housing.
And now they're illegal.
You could not build them. And like the premise of having these, like, you just have a, what is probably most familiar to people, sort of like a dorm living situation where you have your bedroom and then your bathroom, et cetera, that stuff is at the end of the hall or whatever. That's not legal. You couldn't do that today. You couldn't build those. And it wouldn't be supported by these same types of people, even though it provides an easy accommodation for the types of living arrangements that a lot of people who are currently homeless need, right?
Yeah.
And like, if you think about it, we've gone the other way over the course of the past like 80 years or whatever. We've always had an issue with homelessness, particularly centered around Skid Row. Now it is much more regionalized and worse than it has ever been. But like over the course of the 20th century, we demolished all of the boarding houses on Bunker Hill, and yeah. we got rid of the housing that was in Chavez Ravine, and like We're doing it again in Inglewood. We work very assiduously to destroy housing that is currently being used by people who have lower incomes. And then when it comes time to like actually provide replacement housing for those people, we're just like, well, haven't we done enough yeah. already?
And instead we push them out to the fringes.
Right.
Literally.
Yeah.
To like Commerce and El Monte, which are some of the only places left that do actually have housing that is kind of affordable. So this is, I just want people to think of this when they hear what I heard the other night from people working for Councilmember O'Farrell's office, that these people don't want services. You hear that over and over again.
Yeah.
This is what they're offering.
Yep.
They're offering you like as if it's like a better option to go stay in a motel 15 miles away from anything that you know, with no means of accessing any of the resources at your disposal in Los Angeles, or separating from your partner mm-hmm. and your pet, the only people like providing you security, and staying in a place with a bunch of strangers that probably has very harsh curfews and stuff.
Right.
It's services that make the tent seem much more appealing.
Absolutely.
Places where you have companionship, freedom, access to like the neighborhood that you probably grew up in.
The ability to associate with the people of your choosing.
Yes.
Right?
Like and these are the services that they're offering a pregnant woman who has a housed person working his connections to advocate for her. I promise these options are way, way better than what most people are getting. So it's the idea that people don't want services, like the services are garbage.
They're bad.
Right.
They're
now. Bad. And yeah. that was something that Steve Lopez kind of implied in a later column that I think is correct. He wrote a column basically saying nobody is in charge of homelessness right now. Lhasa has no authority to impose any kind of plan.
Mm-hmm.
It is all distributed among the mayor and city council, who none of whom wants anything to do with like taking like a leadership role in this crisis.
Well, it's kind of an ideal situation for them. Lhasa is a joint organization with power split between the city and the county, city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles. And for the politicians, that's fantastic, because this yeah. is a very sticky situation for them politically, where they can instead say, that's Lhasa's job. I even though they hold most of the authority of empowering Lhasa to do anything that would remediate the situation potentially, yeah. they can distance themselves from it by saying it's not directly a city function, which is in certain cases an outright lie.
Yeah. And they're also not funding it sufficiently. So next week it's going to rain 3 days in a row.
Yeah.
Right now. The winter shelters aren't open until December.
Wow.
Big article came out in the LA Times this week that they say they don't have the funding to open the winter shelters, which are dog shit.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's so few beds. If you live in, like, where CeeLo works, like the Silver Lake, Los Feliz area, one of the reasons that we really started advocating was because there was nowhere for people to go when it rained anyway. And even those meager options aren't available until December.
Meanwhile, like, we have LA Mayor Eric Garcetti coming out. So in the wake of Deval Patrick and who was the other guy who jumped in the race?
Bloomberg.
Yeah, Bloomberg. The other guy.
Deval Patrick must be feeling pretty good about that.
Please somebody forward this to him. So in the wake of those two late entries into the Democratic primaries, there was a renewed question put to Eric Garcetti about whether or not he felt good about his decision to stay out of the race or whether he would reconsider entering the presidential campaign season. And he said that, you know, like, there's so much to do as mayor. I know I made the right decision. If you think back about it, there were fires in Los Angeles, and my time just has to go towards, like, Los Angeles. If you think about, though, what you just said, like the emergency shelters not being opened, the continuing crisis on our streets for people who are unhoused, not for their neighbors who do have shelter, but for the people who are actually living on the streets. What is he doing? Like, I get, like, I feel like when he says, oh, there was a fire, it's like, oh, I have to be in Los Angeles in case I need to call the fire chief and have them go protect one of my friends' homes again, mm-hmm. but not like there are current crises that he is dealing with on an ongoing basis here. I just don't see it.
Yeah. And also at the time, of course, he said that he could essentially telecommute as mayor while he was campaigning, and said that it takes so long for him to drive to the other side of town anyway that he might as well be in Iowa. Those are both like actual quotes.
Yes.
We do want to talk about, I don't actually want to talk about this, but we're going to. This report on vacancy rates in Los Angeles, particularly in downtown.
Yeah.
This report was a collaboration between SAGE, Strategic Action for a Just Economy, and ACE, Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, plus a few law students from UCLA, about how vacancy rates are high around Los Angeles, was the thesis of this report, particularly in a collection of luxury condo buildings downtown. Mm-mm. They found a vacancy rate of 70% in those buildings. And the top line conclusion that I saw reported all over the place, like NPR, like a national picked it up, was that there are more vacant units in Los Angeles than there are people who are homeless.
Right.
And this is something that we've heard repeated in like a number of contexts for a long time. Nationally, it's true. In a lot of cities, it's true. But it's true in Los Angeles as well. This was part of their advocacy for a vacancy tax, which would impose penalties on property owners who essentially squat on their properties, just like sit on their properties and let them just appreciate in value and don't rent them out to tenants. Which would increases our issues with like constrained supply in the city, because even like the units that we have available are not being inhabited by people. There were some criticisms about some sloppy math and like sort of deceptive reporting in this study. In particular, I think the LAist reported that the actual vacancy rate in those 10 buildings since April 2019, which was the period they were referring to, has gone from 70% to 30%, because a lot of the buildings had just opened. Mm-hmm. One had opened that same month.
Right.
Basically, it takes time for these units to fill up. Still, 30% is a very high vacancy rate. And there is obviously an issue with at the very top of the market. Like that, what I wish were the top line of the study was they basically saw that in downtown, almost everything that's getting built is at the upper end of the market.
Which and now we have, when we were talking earlier this week about this, you mentioned Circa, right? Like the downward pressure that a vacancy tax might exert on such a like upper luxury apartment complex like Circa, would not still make it accessible to anyone experiencing homelessness or almost anybody else. It still would be super, super expensive. We have other major luxury developments like the Oceanwide Plaza, which is now up for sale.
Yeah, it's dead. It's going to be like 70, the Target husk.
Yeah, except like casting a shadow 4 miles around. But yeah, no, so that is a valid concern. Like, who are we actually building these units for? Who will they ever be occupied by? That being said, there is, I believe Stephen Sharp from Urbanize LA said that the vacancy rate for, I think it was him on Twitter, was saying that the vacancy rate for these apartment complexes downtown, the ones that are at least 1 year old, is like 5% or something like that, which is more in line with what you would expect.
That said, we've talked about vacancy tax is good policy. There are a lot of people that use these units as investment opportunities and don't live in them. Second home tax is good policy. It's also policy that is right now basically rolling downhill, like has plenty of momentum within the city council to get on the ballot. Mike Bonin put one forward earlier this year. He has 3 co-sponsors on it. Like, the city is on board. It doesn't need a huge amount of political momentum to get through city council at this point. Probably will need some more when it comes to like passing a vote, depending on whether it needs 2/3 or a majority or whatever. The thing that I am worried about and is already happening is that figure that makes all the headlines, that more vacant units than people who are homeless, is used to stop the construction of new affordable housing, new housing that is targeted at housing people who are housing insecure, who would otherwise be homeless. It's already going around next door everywhere. People saying, we have the units. Just give those places to people who are homeless, which fine, like, great, do that. Expropriate them. Like, I don't care.
Right.
Like, house a few tens of thousands of people that way. But really, what's much more likely to happen with this tax is it encourages buildings like Circa and what Oceanwide like would have been, like these huge luxury buildings, to just fill these units up with the richest people on earth. Like, it maybe bring down the price slightly so that they end up being occupied. That to me is not like a giant win. Whatever the vacancy tax ends up being would bring in, I guess, some income to the city. But I worry so much about the messaging. We've talked about before about how that number, that figure of like there are more people who are, fewer people who are homeless than there are vacant apartments, is this kind of dumb math that doesn't account for the hundreds of thousands of people who are housing insecure in Los Angeles, the enormous rent burden, larger than anywhere else in the country, being placed on people, the number of people who have to commute in 2 hours from other counties to work here and would love to live in the city center. There's an enormous demand, not just from like young, like white millennials, like coming in from around the country, but from people who are lower income, like who are from this area, who are being pushed out. There is a housing shortage in Los Angeles of about 500,000 affordable units.
Yes.
And that number of there are more vacant units than unhoused people undermines the much bigger political lift that is building those new affordable units.
I mean, so like as far as I'm concerned, I think there's broad agreement in at least the Los Angeles, I would say, like the people who are actively talking about housing in Los Angeles, the people who are talking about housing justice in Los Angeles. I feel like there's broad agreement that there's not just one housing crisis, but there are multiple affecting every level from people who have no access to housing to people who are like in the middle class solidly and still cannot afford their housing or are rent burdened. Each of those are different crises demanding different responses in terms of policy. But of course, the more that housing is constrained, the more that the access to housing is constrained, the more that those crises blend together and you have what we currently have, which is just kind of like a nasty free-for-all where everybody is fighting over scraps while the most housing secure people on the planet enjoy incredible growth in their housing equity and landlords enjoy all of the economic growth that we're making as a state, because they just extract it entirely from workers.
Yeah.
It's not a tenable situation. I was posting on Twitter recently about my own like look into the situation of public housing in Los Angeles. And I think that any claim that there is sufficient housing in Los Angeles directly undercuts what I think that we should do in Los Angeles, which is build a lot of public housing.
Yeah.
We have basically none of it here. We have a very, very tiny amount of public housing in the city of Los Angeles. And that is owing directly to the high standard of living for white people in the decades following World War II, when a lot of other older cities were actually building public housing. We refused to do so on the basis that the perception was it would only benefit Black people and Latinos. Mm-hmm. And that was just not something that like racist mayors like Sam Yorty would countenance. They didn't want to do it. So we have essentially none. 99.5% of the housing stock in the city of Los Angeles is privately owned. So it's hard for me to imagine how you reconcile the belief that there's enough housing in Los Angeles with the construction of public housing units. I would say that those are inherently at odds,
right?
But I think that we need to do that.
Yeah. And but what you're saying is totally true. The people that wrote this report and people that work in like tenants' rights activism and homeless activism in Los Angeles all agree that there is a need to build more affordable housing,
yeah,
like build more units, with the exception of a few very rich people who are pretending to be part of these movements and want the opposite of that. But the thing that and they'll say, all those activists will go out and say, we need more affordable units. We also need a vacancy tax. My fear is that when headlines like there are more vacant units than people who are homeless in Los Angeles get all over the place, go everywhere, then the people who are naturally inclined to resist new housing, homeowners, people in the more suburban parts of the city, like older, wealthier populations, it gives them ammunition to fight back. And that is already happening.
Absolutely.
This article that LAist posted, that headline, and NPR, those are all over Nextdoor already.
Yeah. And so then you end up with the thought that the empty apartment is most emblematic of what is wrong with California's housing economy, that that there is an empty apartment somewhere that somebody should be living in, which is, you know, like there is an issue there. But there is also the issue that is something else that I've seen reported recently, which is that there are 20 times as many like empty bedrooms in single family homes than there are homeless people.
Yeah.
You know, like there, that is separately emblematic of a different aspect of this issue.
Yeah.
Right.
Our guest is here. We are going to talk to her in 1 second, Jessica Meany, about bus lanes on LA Podcast.
Okay. Today we have a wonderful guest, Jessica Meany, executive director and founder of Investing in Place, a transportation policy think tank and advocacy group here in Los Angeles, one that I have volunteered for a bunch in the past and whose work I'm generally always excited to hear about. So very good to get you here to give us an update on what you guys are working on. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you, Scott. Hello, Hayes.
Welcome, Jessica.
Very exciting to be here.
Can you talk to us a bit about what Investing in Place is, and just like, where did you guys come from? How did you get your start? And yeah, what is the background for you guys?
Sure. So I describe Investing in Place just like you did, nonprofit transportation advocacy group. Got our start. I've been lucky enough to be a professional transportation advocate in Southern California for about 10 years. About 5 years ago, we had a lot of momentum around ideas of increasing funding for sidewalks, bike lanes, safe routes to school, Vision Zero. And we knew Measure M was coming. It was like 2014.
Yeah.
And I was working for a national nonprofit that was dialing back its work in LA. A lot of us got together and we're like, we need a homegrown LA-based group that is, well, lots of groups fighting project by project, neighborhood by neighborhood, and a lot of what I would call old boy network kind of power groups in LA around transportation. No center space of research, policy, bridge building to move the money. And also one of the reasons we started a lot with a huge focus on countywide is that's where all of the money is. Now we have 4 sales taxes, right? So we can be grumpy with Sacramento and DC, but in reality, the 13 Metro board members control an annual budget of what, $7 billion a year? That is almost 65 to 70% our local county sales taxes. So building a countywide advocacy group.
Incredibly refreshing approach compared to what you hear so often at the city and county level, which is that, oh, the state and like, oh, Trump won't give us the money for all this good stuff. Right. But you're saying the money is there.
Oh, yeah. It's the problem in LA County about transportation is absolutely not money. I don't know, Scott, you might have seen it. Metro just released its 15-year finance plan, which is something like $121 billion they expect to invest in LA County, the majority controlled by our Metro Board of Directors. So if we are not building power to influence what's going on at Metro, we're continuing to fight these small scale projects.
So how do you approach changing the priorities? Because I think what we've talked about a lot in on this podcast in particular is how a group like the Metro Board of Directors routinely will prioritize capital spending, or they'll prioritize things that are politically expedient that will be like really headline grabbing things, the work on the Blue Line, at the expense of the more mundane aspects of transit service, providing bus lanes, providing frequent service, providing bus shelters or street trees. Like, how do you go about changing those priorities?
Well, so for a long time, I thought we could change it by data and policy. And as I reflect on my role in this work as an advocate, I'm beginning to rethink what we're doing and if we've built power in the right places. Because I kind of believe that Metro has all of the right policies in place. What we don't have is the power to move our policymakers. I'm deeply concerned on what I see going on with 28 by 28 in a real feeding frenzy of who has the most power to get their projects accelerated.
Yeah. 28 by 28, we've talked about a lot on the show, but this is primarily led by Mayor Garcetti, a group of 28 projects, transit projects to be finished by the 2028 Olympics.
Yeah, and it's not really 28 anymore, really. I think it's more like 23. You guys are probably But it's what I see happening at Metro is, of course, we don't see. So we're all also like, one thing I always think is important to keep in mind, we get obsessed, lots of conversations about Measure M.
Right. Which is the sales tax, most recent sales tax to fund billions of dollars towards transit.
Yeah, widespread voter support for a real change in our transportation network. But at the same time, we have Prop A, C, and R flowing at the same exact amount as Measure M.
Yep.
So that's a tremendous amount of money. But we don't see a Measure M check all at once. We have to every year get some of the sales taxes accumulated. But there is an incredible thing going on of everyone fighting to accelerate their project to the top of the list and jump the queue, and absolutely no power building or pressure to put bus riders and the people who are currently using the system, the really shitty system that's out there,
right,
to accelerate operating, user experience improvements, what we experience with the Blue Line without any safety improvements, things like that. There's just a highly, as you know, capital intensive push with sometimes what gets really lost is the design elements that make it accessible.
You mentioned that there are policies in place that are basically just not being followed through on. What are some of those?
Well, I think you know, Complete Streets policy. We worked together. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot. It was heartbreaking to see, you know, the 710 North when we finally ended it and they put all the money that had been set aside to expand the freeway into local street improvements. We saw cities put forward multimodal projects, bike lanes, bus only lanes, and we saw a Metro Highway staff prioritize things that expanded it for cars and openly admit on committee floor that they did not think the award-winning Metro 2014 Complete Streets policy applied to them. I'm sarcastic about the award-winning thing because it got APA, all these awards, a way to go Metro on your Complete Streets policy, but when they're literally allocating billions of dollars, the agency doesn't think it applies to them.
What would the Complete Streets policy have done if implemented? When you're looking at all of this money that we're taking out of the 710 North expansion project that would have extended the freeway from Alhambra up to South Pasadena, instead, that project gets canceled. If Metro were actually holding true to its Complete Streets policy, what would that have looked like?
The metrics would have been different. We heard highway staff continually say that their priority was to plan for more cars, literally saying we have more people in the suburbs, we have more cars. All true, but they were using metrics that were from like very old school. And how do our streets accommodate more capacity when we know the current thinking and planning, widening roadways isn't going to do that. We really need to think about how to move more people, more cars. And so it would have improved the metrics and the prioritization of what was funded. And we've continued to see that around Metro policies of, and also with the city of Los Angeles. We have wonderful policies. Vision Zero.
Mobility plan.
Mobility plan galore. And so I get approached a lot by outside companies of LA who are like, oh, we got this data. We can help you figure this out. And it's not a data problem. It's not a money problem. It's a power problem.
It's not even a planning problem. It's because the plans are there.
Yeah.
And Metro has put a lot of these out, advocating for protected bike lanes, dedicated bus lanes along major arteries, but it's individual elected officials who are killing these projects in their districts.
Yeah.
Or not pushing for them?
Right.
What makes it a power problem?
I've been reflecting on my role as a professional advocate, and I think the transportation movement needs to grow up and needs to evolve and start to link arms with other progressive base building efforts we see in Los Angeles. I had a very influential civic leader tell me the other day that she thought the region had issue fatigue, that we were fighting lots of important issues, housing, immigration, education, prison reform, that they couldn't take on transportation. Mm-hmm. My thinking is, how are we creating an intersectional agenda that, and moving away from this crap about transportation is how fast, how far, yeah, but what kind of city do we want to live in? And is it a way to get to work, get to see your family? And I just think, as I can only take responsibility really for some of the work I do, but I don't think we've worked enough with the progressive base building spaces to bring resources and technical expertise on transportation to their agendas. I mean, when's the last time we had an intersectional progressive agenda that actually built power? So I'm super grumpy with some of our elected officials, but I'm also reflective of what are we doing to actually push them and hold them accountable the way the street vending movement does, the way the housing movement does.
So you're saying if we were able to have, from a political standpoint, a linking up of some of these issues that are affecting different aspects of social life in Los Angeles, that I think are, you said rightly, very, there's an intersection there, that then we could potentially start to see more change rapidly in different directions, as opposed to having issue-based movements in each area.
When I look at what's happened in transportation over the past 10 years of advocacy, yeah. I mean, when I started doing stuff in 2005, 2008, there was Midnight Riders. I don't know if you guys ever did that. It was so exciting. It was so inclusive, but it also kind of led to a lot of angry white men who were pushing, but we weren't actually building capacity in other partner organizations. And then those guys moved on. So I also think getting back to the whole reason a lot of us do this work is, for me, the most marginalized have the least options and the most dangerous options for getting around and getting to work. What I worry the most about in Los Angeles is this incredibly growing huge gap between the rich and the poor. And I continue to feel like the mayor's office is quite comfortable talking to people they agree with, things that are serving wealthy people, the tech companies. I am having a really hard time accepting this exciting street lamp redesign. I don't know if you guys saw the beach umbrellas that the city bought from Home Depot for bus shelters. Uh-huh. It's heartbreaking when you also look that every 3 days somebody gets killed walking across the street, and we want pretty street lamps. And also, can we just fix the fucking street lamps first?
Right.
There's Hillary Norton often tells me there's 1,000 street lamps broken in a small part of downtown alone. Mm. So, but what that tells me is the mayor's office and other elected officials are very comfortable talking to certain people about certain issues, which tends to benefit those with the most privilege and access and resources. How are we building power from to represent social justice and the working poor? Like the BRU did, right? So what space is actually organizing and supporting people who ride the bus now?
Right. So you're talking about the Bus Riders Union, which was able to successfully get a federal consent decree levied against Metro in the, I believe, early 2000s.
90s.
Or late 90s. And the suit that they brought against Metro was saying that Metro was redirecting money to wealthier rail riders and to Metrolink at the expense of service for poor bus riders. And the federal government agreed and was at that time in a position to force Metro to provide significantly enhanced bus service for about 10 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. From that point in time to the present, the ability of outside groups like the Bus Riders Union to successfully bring suits like that under FTA guidance has been diminished substantially. And so they've tried to sue Metro a number of times since then and have lost those suits. And we don't have, I guess that's really my question when you're talking about building power is, from your perspective, how can outside groups hold Metro directors, hold the mayor's office accountable to the things that they say they're doing? Because when we're talking about the Complete Streets policy, which you mentioned was passed or which was written in 2014 and was much lauded at the time for being a very progressive vision of a future LA where different users of streets were afforded the same level of respect by the people who were designing the streets. All that really did was get a lot of good press for Metro, for city officials, took up several years and a lot of people's time to complete, but then there's no follow through. Who can supply accountability to the people who are not implementing these policies once they're put in place?
I mean, I think that's something I'm trying to figure out right now. I would say it's a rethinking of our strategies. And I've done a lot of work with the public agencies over the past several years. And I think we need to actually now take a lesson from some of our other advocates in other sectors and actually start creating our own agendas from that are community led. Because, like, for instance, I've been working for almost 2 years with the city, with Metro, to spend some of their what they call active transportation money in Measure M and convincing them that they really should be focusing on first and last mile and improving access around bus stops. Their proposal is to fix within like a quarter of a mile of a bus stop. If you live within a quarter of a mile of a bus stop, you're fine.
Yeah.
It's the idea of someone who's traveling farther. The idea, like, they just continue to shrink down their responsibility on access issues. And that's like crazy. So how do we hold them accountable? I think we need to rethink a lot of how we talk about transportation, whose voices are being amplified, and what kind of organizing that looks like. And we have so many progressive base building organizations in Los Angeles County. How are we inviting them into these larger conversations? And then tactically, what I've shifted a little bit, I'm thinking about more and more in 2020, is it's super hard to convince people that buses are good the way they are. What are they, 12 miles, 7 miles an hour? Ridiculously slow.
Definitely sub 10 miles an hour.
Right. When you say it's hard to convince people that they're good the way they are, you mean the way they are makes it hard to convince people, not that they're good the way they are right now.
Right. Yeah. Like, it's hard to build an exciting movement over like, let's support Metro buses if you have only experienced what we see now.
Right.
We see cities across the country and of course globally dedicating road space to it. Flower Street got really excited. People got really excited when we saw a bus only lane. So what I'm thinking is like, can we do anything in the next year that is transformative on our streets that lots of people can experience and see? And that is trickling up as opportunity in downtown Los Angeles, which has the ability to impact bus lines, like a gazillion bus lines going in and out of Los Angeles. And the city and Metro have indicated an openness to looking at bus only lanes on 5th, 6th and 7th, and then Grand and Olive. So 5th, imagine you're at Pershing Square, and you're going all the way past the library up to the freeway. If we can consolidate and move some buses onto that street and get them out of traffic. And can we do that the way we did Flower Street in 6 to 8 months?
Right.
And then there's, you've seen the list that Metro's next gen bus plan has of, we have so many high performing buses that sit in traffic. So the idea is, if can we get some shit done in downtown Los Angeles that dramatically improves the bus experience, build some power, build some energy, build some new voices and champions, and then start to do that elsewhere in the city and the region.
I mean, I think if you're talking about the like 5th is in downtown Los Angeles, an extension of the freeway on-ramp onto the 110, basically. Yeah. But it is also where the 720 and the 20 go through. It's like one of the busiest bus routes in the city is right there on that stretch of downtown. Like you mentioned, again, on Hill and Olive, you have so many buses that use that stretch of road. And when traffic is bad there for the buses, you are going probably 5 miles an hour. It is walking speed. If you are able-bodied, it's like it's not helping you to be on the bus. So getting those bus-only lanes in that part of downtown would be very exciting. Yeah. It would be transformational.
And it's the movement going on the offensive in a cool way when it does feel like in recent years we're just unsuccessfully trying to prevent cuts to services instead of really fighting hard for building these things out. I think it's interesting what you were talking about with the housing movement, because they have been successful in base building and bringing together so many groups of advocates and people from impacted populations in a way that has been effective, sort of on the defensive in some cases. But City of LA has moved a lot in a short time in terms of whether or not they are criminalizing people who are homeless. Like the rhetoric around sweeps to cleanups has really changed, and the practices have as well. Transportation advocates, what I can kind of hear you saying is it's more associated with urbanism in a lot of spaces, which is like making neighborhoods more accessible and beautifying them in a way that's not necessarily for lower income communities. It's like about a certain type of idealized urban living more than anything else, and in some cases is seen as promoting gentrification, especially when it comes to bikes, in a way that a lot of lower income communities are kind of wary of. So how do you shift that conversation to be about improving situations for low income people instead of wealthier people?
I think letting them lead. I think letting people of color lead who have the lived experience and the expertise. And I think, like me as a white woman of privilege, how am I bringing the access and the resources that I have to expand the table? I think that that's something I wish I had realized earlier. And I think that I've been involved in a lot of conversations around equity that are fatiguing by certain agencies who talk ad nauseum about it, but refuse to prioritize resources in a meaningful way. So to me, like, while I would love to be championing bus only lanes in South Central, in San Fernando Valley, all across the city, particularly in our highly impacted communities, if we can start in downtown and impact up to 30, 40, so many bus mm-hmm. lines and see success mm-hmm. and bring new champions to do that, I'm hopeful. I mean, I think if we can start to build a more inclusive movement around better buses, that's social justice in itself. But what fucking annoys me is I talk to people sometimes, I'm like, Metro is doing nothing on equity. And people are like, well, they're running buses. And I'm like, if that's your best buses. Like economic access improvement quality, the state of buses right now. So I think we, for me at least, I need to sit down and think about how am I amplifying other voices, but also bringing the expertise and the resources and the networks I have after doing this work for so long. But shifting a little bit for me, I love policy work, but without the power, it's just like award-winning policies Metro has without that they can choose to ignore.
I would say for me, the idea of putting bus lanes in downtown would have an immediate high visibility impact for so many people who are current bus riders. Although the system has lost a lot of ridership mm-hmm. over the past 5 years, there are still a ton of people for whom the bus system is a lifeline. And I feel like one of the big differences between the housing movement that Hayes is talking about and transportation advocacy is just the visibility of the issue. And mm-hmm. for a lot of people, their experience in Los Angeles is that transportation in Los Angeles means cars mm-hmm. and the invisibility of the transit system, let alone the inscrutability of the people who actually control the transit system, means that it is that much harder to focus people on this is something that we can do immediately to benefit the lives of lower income Angelenos. And that is really unfortunate. Like, if you think about the past year, we had, you mentioned the Flower Street bus lane, and Investing in Place had an amazing tweet about the bus lane that I
had a viral moment
was thrilled about. Yeah. But that was kind of like this bright moment when most of what has been happening on the transit system is you have Metro closing the Blue Line, formerly the busiest light rail line in America, for like 10 and a half months with no repercussions, like no controversy. It was just like, okay, we're just closing it, reopening it. It seems like not much has changed if you're not a marketing person. And then there was something else that was going on where the transit wins. Oh, the bus cuts. There's just like the wins have been few and far between. And I feel like there is just the visibility needs to be there, right? Yeah. Like the people need to be aware of how significantly this is affecting hundreds of thousands of people's lives on a daily basis when our public officials fail to do their jobs. The way that it started to come up with Vision Zero, the inability of the city to actually follow through on its promise to eliminate traffic deaths.
Yeah. But I think like lessons learned from the couple years ago, Vision Zero, like I think we're going to see, I mean, the data that's coming out of the massive increase in people dying on our streets in LA is heartbreaking. And I think needs to see an organized power. Like I talked to Laura Raymond and ACT LA, they're a coalition that organizes affordable housing partners. Right. And Laura said to me something like they stopped waiting for the city to do things and they like literally wrote JJJ. What's the transportation community going to do, or people who care about access for all? Are we going to do, and things like that? And like, so somebody recently told me, hey, can you turn out people for this committee meeting in 2 weeks? And I was like, what's it about? They're like, well, we want you to champion X, Y, and Z. And I was like, well, where's the project? Well, we can't really tell you that, but we really need people to champion it. And that thinking from public agencies of not being transparent. Where
that
the
was
project
from Metro?
So. I was actually a different agency. Oh, okay. But different department. But the lack of agencies' willingness to commit to what it takes to support authentic community engagement, the long build, the transparency, the allowing projects to change. Like I am somewhat fatigued on asking people to turn out to Metro committee meetings for 60 seconds of glory and whatever, when actually we need them to be building power in their own neighborhoods and their own meetings, because this stuff of not, like, even the next gen is a really good example of what's going on with the Metro Next Gen plan. Year and a half in, I as a professional who was invited to a 3.5-hour meeting that Metro held without an agenda on Next Gen, I'm still really unclear of what we're deciding.
Yeah.
How do we, but they're like, well, can you get people to show up in January and get people excited? And I'm like, for what? Mm-hmm. How, if we are sincerely trying to bring in communities on what impacts their ability to get around, we need incredible more commitment from our public agencies and transparency, a longer game, and capacity building for civic engagement.
Yeah.
That does harm what you're talking about, having people show up for these meetings and advocate for something, and it gets approved, and then nothing really happens, or what ends up happening is much worse than what people thought they were advocating for.
Bait and switch. It's a setup for a bait and switch.
And
right?
It reduces engagement going forward in whatever the thing is. On homelessness, too. Yeah. The city will ask us all the time, like, oh, this safe parking lot, well, like, come out and advocate for this. And then whatever, 3 years later, it still hasn't shown up, and it's impossible to really get behind stuff anymore because you don't know if it's going to happen.
Right, right.
So what do you need now? Like, what can, like, if someone's listening to this and says, I support this, I want to get behind better buses, lanes downtown.
Yeah. So what I would love is for a diverse, inclusive campaign of all sorts of voices championing bus only lanes, and also really talking to our incoming council members of the election that we see in Council District 14, making sure that Kevin De Leon, Monica Garcia, all of our candidates are championing these things. So 7th Street has been long conversations on how to turn 7th Street into a transit mall. It's in desperate need of barrier protected bike lanes, scooter mm-hmm. lanes. Mm-hmm. There's money on the table from that big hotel. Are our incoming council members going to support that? And then we have monthly work group meetings and investing in place for better buses that people can come to. But we're really
open to the public.
It's totally open to the public. And I'm actually thinking about doing more weekend stuff or after hours things to broaden it. I've started doing some conversations with the Central City Association, some of the bids, and how are we doing a cross sector and getting out of our silos that I, for one, fully live in sometimes, to build unlikely partnerships that have nothing to do with the public agencies, but are building our own power. Mm-hmm. And then we're coming to them with, this is what we want.
Tough thing there, I can imagine, is that those same organizations have often come into conflict with some of the advocacy groups around housing and homelessness. I mean, if you're talking about bids
and street vending,
like things like that.
Yep.
Hard to build partnerships between those organizations and advocacy groups for lower income people.
And it probably will be hard to do this, but I, so far, people who I've talked to welcome the opportunity to come early in on a idea of, like, can we do it? Are we up for it? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone is desperate for some improved access in downtown. And then you start to get at economic things of, like, can your employees actually get to work? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's that. And a DOT and the city has designs of what elevated bike lanes on 7th look like, what making it prioritized transit. We just need the power to implement it. I mean, and another thing too, that's like, Scott knows this, you've been at our Tripping Point conferences, is driving me crazy is the city's delinquent pace on fixing our public right of way.
Right.
I think I was in a meeting where they were celebrating that the city last year fixed 18 miles of sidewalks. Overall, the city of Los Angeles has about 10,000 miles.
Yeah.
And about 4,000 are estimated to be broken or disrepair. Uh-huh. So it's like ludicrous the lack of support we have for this, the basic form of mobility, whether you're walking or rolling. And now there's this whole idea about a new street furniture contract, which is about putting ads on our sidewalks to create revenue. And there's even a lot of it's really directed at the Olympics and this idea of creating digital billboards within our sidewalks.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy.
I haven't even heard about that.
The impact the Olympics is having on our mobility issues is tremendous. But okay, so if you want to commercialize our public right-of-way, is all of that money going into fixing our sidewalks, supporting lower fees for street vendors, supporting our people who don't have homes, who sleep on the streets, to improve how that all works together? So far, the city is very silent on what a larger vision looks like to figure out how to reconcile all the competing uses on our sidewalks with its desire to make money off it.
With bus shelters too, like that goes hand in hand with new advertising to pay for it. I'm sure eventually they would say, like, well, great, we'll fix this sidewalk and it pays for itself because it'll be like this giant LED thing under your feet. Wow. Remember when Domino's a few years ago was fixing potholes?
They still do it.
Yeah.
It's a wildly successful program.
With the Domino's logo. I don't know. It feels like there must be.
It's a wildly successful program in that people ask for potholes to get fixed and Domino's responds. I don't know if we can say that about the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah. But there, we have a massive marketing budget for the city. There could be a way to get, like, the promo out there from the city instead of billboards or whatever, that like, I would be much more supportive of that kind of like city advocacy on like a sidewalk LED thing instead of like, I don't know, Juul or whatever. Like,
I mean, we have $2 billion in tax dollars coming into LA County every year for transportation. Mm-hmm. The we can fix our sidewalks. We can have high quality bus shelters that are not beach umbrellas from Home Depot. It is all doable. We are choosing to be obsessed in these other kind of areas and not really put our money where our mouth is in caring about social equity and access and people's ability to get to the jobs. I mean, the mayor's office talks about equity, has wonderful visions and speeches and policies that are never funded, never supported, and never implemented. So it's really, I think, starting to be reconciled, the disconnect that at least you guys probably have already reconciled this stuff, but more and more, because I've been in those press conferences where I'm like, mm-hmm. I went to the sidewalk press conference where the mayor was like, you know, we can't look up to the stars if we're tripping on our sidewalks. And that was 5 years ago. And so I was so inspired at that presser. I was like, yeah that's awesome. But we're not seeing implementation.
Nothing changes.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Sums it up pretty well, I think. Thank you so much, Jessica Meany from Investing in Place.
Thank you for having me.
For coming on the show. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye.